move to the sixth case this morning, U.S. versus Johnson.
May it please the Court, my name is John Drake, and I represent the defendant appellant, Mr. Craig Johnson. Mr. Johnson is challenging several aspects of his sentence, which was imposed after he was convicted of being a felon in possession of a firearm in the Eastern District of Wisconsin under Judge Randa. There are several issues Mr. Johnson is challenging, but the common theme or element is a lack of findings, specific findings, for the increase in the sentence and a lack of clarity for what the judge did and why he did it. The main issue, and the first one, is the obstruction of justice enhancement under 3C1.1, which was imposed for alleged perjury. The district court made no findings, let alone specific findings, that Mr. Johnson gave false testimony, that it was material, or that he intended to specifically obstruct justice. The district court actually acknowledged that what Mr. Johnson essentially did was a mere denial of guilt, which the guidelines talk about, is not a basis for imposing the obstruction enhancement. The district court, after talking about his testimony, said, "So one could just say that is just a defense. That's the defendant's story." The court then went on to talk about its real focus in imposing the obstruction enhancement, which was Mr. Johnson's testimony about his two prior felonies. That, of course, can't be the basis for an obstruction enhancement. In this case, it has to be testimony about the instant offense. And there's also other problems because his testimony about the prior crimes was not false and it was not material, again, material to this case or to the length of the sentence. The district court seemed unhappy with Mr. Johnson's referring to a .45 caliber gun, which was the gun in the previous crime, as an old Army gun or a real old gun. That's not a false statement. It is an old Army gun. It's not the gun the Army longer uses. It's also the product of a reasonable mistake. Mr. Johnson is not familiar with those kind of firearms. The district court explained that the judge personally had used this gun while in military service, had fired the gun recently. He indicated he seemed to have an appreciation for the weapon, which is all fine and good, but imposing the obstruction enhancement for characterizing a weapon from a previous crime, and when Mr. Johnson did not call it an antique weapon, that word never appears in the transcript in the trial. That can't be the basis for the obstruction enhancement. The other prior crime that the district court seemed to be focusing on for this obstruction enhancement was a party to possession with intent to distribute. Now, Mr. Johnson did say that he was involved in sharing drugs and getting high when he talked about that crime, but he also admitted to committing that crime. He admitted to the actual name, that actual title of the crime, several times. That's in both in cross and direct examination. So adding or elaborating to the fact that it stemmed from sharing drugs is not false. That's not inconsistent with the crime. The judge made no credibility findings, and the judge even acknowledged on the issue of materiality. At one point, he said it did not matter whether or not the gun was in Mr. Johnson's pocket or not. Now, that was in the context of a jury instruction argument, but I think it goes to the point of Mr. Johnson's denial of possession of the gun. He said he didn't have it on him. The police said it was in his pocket. It could have been in the gun, in the car. That's still consistent with his conviction, but it doesn't necessarily mean it was a material misstatement under the law for the obstruction enhancement. Another problematic issue below in the sentence was increasing the sentence based on the criminal history category being inadequate. in the judge's words. Now, under Booker, the court does not have to follow Section 4A1.3 word for word. It can use it by analogy or as a guidepost, this court has said. But it still should do that by analogy, by a guidepost. The court did not follow it at all. If you increase a sentence for criminal conduct that did not result in points, it has to be, should be, prior similar and adult criminal conduct. What the court used was juvenile conduct and also dissimilar conduct, conduct that did not involve weapons, as this charge did. It also wasn't clear whether this March 8, 2006 incident, where charges were dismissed against Mr. Johnson, but his other people involved in that crime were convicted. On the one hand, it said it was considering that, and then in the next sentence it said that that case was not in the record or before the record, so it was unclear whether it was using that case. There was not a clear basis for why it was increasing the sentence based on this supposedly inadequate criminal history category. 4A1.3 was not followed by analogy or a guidepost at all. And the third and last major issue is whether the sentence should have been concurrent or consecutive, because Mr. Johnson was arrested for this crime while he was on supervised release for a previous crime. 5G1.3C in the commentary says that the court should consider a number of factors to decide whether the sentence should be concurrent or consecutive. The court gave no indication that it knew it had the discretion to do that, didn't mention any of those factors. Its 3553A discussion was just devoted to the length of the sentence, not whether it should be concurrent or consecutive, and that mistake was enough for a remand in the Jackson case from 2008 that's cited in the brief. Even under the plain error standard, which would probably apply in this case because there was not an explicit objection on this issue. Under Brassel, this mistake, not considering the factors at all, so that this court can't be satisfied that the proper issues were considered, is enough for a remand and resentencing under plain error. There's obviously a prejudice because his sentence is longer, and his fundamental rights obviously are affected liberty. There are no other questions. I'll reserve the rest of my time for
rebuttal. Thank you, Mr. Drake.
Lipscomb?
Thank you. May it please the Court. My name is Bill Lipscomb. I represent the United States in this matter. I want to just touch upon obstruction and then, if the Court would allow, the concurrent versus consecutive sentencing here. On the obstruction issue, the court is required to find, under the guidelines which apply here, the court has to correctly make findings under the guidelines that the statements at trial were false, willful, and material. The judge here did not specifically find false. He did not specifically find willful. He did not specifically find material. But in the context here of what was before him, which was a very simple set of facts and very simple statements of the defendant and very straightforward testimony of the officers, it really is implicit in what he found. If you look at what the defendant said at trial, the defendant didn't say very much. But what he did say was, in response to counsel's question, did you have a gun in your pocket? Did you have a gun in your possession? No. Had you ever seen a gun that day, essentially the day of the offense? No. And later the defendant said that the first time that he saw the gun was actually at the time of trial. The police officer's testimony was very straightforward. They asked the defendant if he had anything on his person he shouldn't have. He said, yes, I have a gun in my pocket, and they pulled the gun out of his pocket. In consideration of that testimony, the court did make findings. They are not extensive. And sometimes I think it happens with district judges and all of us when we are talking about a set of facts, particularly something that's relatively straightforward. We make statements and then we go on to something else, and that's really what the judge did here. He said, well, relative to the objection, and this is at page 4 through 5 of the sentencing transcript, well, relative to the objection, the court obviously listened to the testimony. And when the defendant was arrested, he was asked, of course, according to the testimony of the officers, whether or not he had anything that he shouldn't have. He said he had a gun in his pocket, which was later denied by the defendant. And then, of course, we went to trial on that issue. Now, that's what's material here, because that's what we went to trial on. And the officers only testified that they took the weapon from the pocket. So the jury believed that testimony. There wasn't any testimony about the gun being in the car, as the defendant it sort of brings up here on appeal. The only testimony was the gun was in the pocket. The judge says, so the jury believed that testimony. That's where it was found. That is the judge's finding here.
Hold on. He goes on to say, on the next line, but so one could say that was just a defense. That is just the defendant's story. The court views the testimony, however, as extraordinary effort to minimize every type of involvement of the defendant with his offense relative to his prior felony drug convictions of the sharing of drugs. And the court has read the records, and it's not in the case. In addition, styling the automatic Colt 45, 9/11, was issued in 9/11, and I'll end the quote, and he goes on. It's not clear whether he's focusing on the statement that the defendant made that he did not have the gun in his pocket. In fact, the judge seems to be excusing that and saying that's just his assertion of innocence, and then seems to go on and say the court views the testimony as an extraordinary effort to minimize every type of involvement, referring to the drug convictions, the prior drug convictions, and the prior felon possession conviction. And neither of those would be material. He stipulated, did he not, to the drug convictions and to the felon in possession.
Yes, Judge. I think this
that's
rises.
Really the problem, isn't it? We can't tell whether he's focusing on a material statement or the gun was not in my pocket.
But I think this is the problem. The judge is really saying everything that the defendant said at trial was misleading, and I don't believe it. Right? He goes through and says that the testimony about the firearm was false because it was not where it was found, right? It was found actually in his pocket. And then he says, as you know, and it's important here to note that what's problematic sometimes is when you read things in a transcript, it appears as if it's a logical nexus from thought to thought to thought, right? But we're human beings. It's not always that simple, right? And so this could be a different paragraph, you know, and it might give us a different sense of it. The judge says, but, so one could say that is just a defense. That is the defendant's story.
But then he goes
but
on
the
to
judge
say,
doesn't
what
believe
I think,
that story.
What I think is extraordinary, he says, and then goes on to talk about these two immaterial statements.
Right.
Minimizing his guilt because the drug conviction, prior drug conviction, wasn't very much, and the gun was an old gun.
And I think that goes to really the judge, in a realistic context, saying this guy is not a credible character. Everything he says is misleading or manipulative, which ties back eventually to the judge's findings at the conclusion of the case, where he looks at the defendant's history, which the judge has a long recitation of the defendant's history, 15 years of criminal offenses over 30 years, manipulation, misleading, chronic lying, chronic recidivism, chronic unsupervisability, right? And the court is looking at all that and says a really harsh penalty is appropriate here, a penalty beyond the guidelines. And all of that, the trial testimony, this sort of extraordinary effort to minimize, is consistent with the defendant's character the court talks about. I think that's really...
Well, the defendant may have a bad character and so on. He apparently isn't a model prisoner by any means, but all these references to his juvenile offenses, and they don't seem to have anything to do with guns, and these guidelines say that you're supposed to focus on adult matters that have something to do with the current offense. So it seems to me he's getting way off the track there.
Well, I think that post-Booker, we can look at what is reasonable. And I think it is unrealistic to ignore juvenile convictions. What the judge's point was, going back in time,
says adult, so that's the problem.
But we're outside the guideline at that point in the proceedings. We are looking at the reasonableness of the sentence. The court
he's relating to possession of weapons that started out when he was a juvenile.
And I think it did start out when he was a juvenile. There are references. Yes, right.
Would you say that he's increasing the penalty because of 3553 factors or because the old 4A1.3 factors where he believes the guidelines under the criminal history category materially underrepresents the seriousness of his past conduct?
I don't think you can separate those out. I mean, because I think in the judges, and this judge in particular, when he looks at the history and characteristics of the defendant, and that's 3553 factors, and this judge, Judge Randall, always focuses on that, and in that context focuses on the defendant's criminal past.
Well, the reason
and that's what he did here.
The reason I ask, when you look at the judgment of conviction, there's a box to check if the criminal history category was inadequate, and he didn't check that. Yet the transcript, he expressly says that.
Yeah, I don't know that that judgment has form has changed since Booker, when it would have been required as part of the guideline calculation.
No, this is under subsection C. It says reason for departures. And the first reason is criminal history category inadequate, and there's a square to be checked. And that was not checked, even though that seems to be the basis of his decision when you read the transcript.
And it is the basis for his decision, Judge. There's no question about that.
The criminal history category was inadequate.
Yes, that's sort of the structure for his decision-making is looking at that factor, which would have been of more moment when the guidelines were mandatory, right? Because we would have had to strictly follow that. Is it appropriate for a court, and this court, in looking at reasonableness, to see whether that squares with that analysis of the guidelines? Yes. But in context here, I think it's just to look at reasonableness for a sentence that was a year and 6 months higher than the guideline range, right? Not an extraordinary, I want to say departure because that's not the language we use anymore, but an increase above the guideline range was reasonable given all that the court talked about here, which really was, when it came down to it, the chronic offense behavior, the fact that he was unsupervisable, the fact that the defendant said, I have no respect for
you
authority.
You asked for 72 months, didn't you?
I'm a very, you know, they call me let him go Lipscomb in my office. I tend to be rather, I don't know, not as harsh as some. But here's a judge who's been on the bench for 34 years and has a different view of what's required in order to protect the public, which is really his duty as well as mine. The last, I would just make a note about concurrent versus consecutive time. The judge did, in a very short shrift again, which unfortunately, talk about concurrent versus consecutive. At page 24 of the sentencing transcript, he refers to my, again, request for a lighter sentence than that. Mr. Lipscomb indicated the sentence was probably on the light side, and he was correct. He's talking about what's necessary here. So the court is going to impose a sentence of 96 months, but it's going to be consecutive to this other case. That's the decision that Judge Charles Clavert entered on the revocation. I see my time is up, but if I could just finish this thought. And his point of that isn't to say that I'm bound by what Judge Clavert says. He's referring really back to what's in the pre-sentence report, and that what's in the pre-sentence report is that Judge Clavert made his decision about revocation and the penalty to be imposed without regard to this new offense. And so he's referring back to that, and essentially that goes to incremental punishment, that to have incremental punishment, it has to be consecutive. And that was the decision of the court. I thank the court for its time. I ask the court to affirm the sentence below.
Thank you, Mr. Lipscomb. Mr. Drake? 2.5 minutes, Mr. Drake.
A couple points briefly here on obstruction of justice. I think, Judge Darrow, you're correct that it was sort of all a mishmash there. The court talked about the current crime, in addition to the points you raised, in the context of and relative to the prior crime. So he's making this direct connection with the testimony about the current crime, with the prior crime. It gets so mixed up that we really don't know why he's making a finding, if he's making a finding of falsity, or whether this testimony was material. Again, the onus is on the district court here to make the record so that this court can review whether enough specifics were there and whether the increase in the sentence was appropriate. And I think when it's as ambiguous and unclear as the sentencing transcript shows, whether or not it has to be in a logical narrative or not. It's just got to be sufficient for this court or for anyone to be able to look at it and figure out the reasons for the increase. There was a great deal of testimony by the defendant, Mr. Johnson. He talked about all sorts of things, but really it only came down to when he was asked very briefly, did you possess the gun? He said no. Have you seen the gun that day? He said no. The theory of the case, the case argued below, was that the gun was in the car. The court said that it did not matter whether it was in his pocket or not. So, again, I think that goes to the issue of materiality. The defendant does have two prior felonies, but I think there is recidivism and then there's recidivism. Many of his prior crimes were mere municipal ordinance violations, disorderly conduct, running away from the police. We're not talking about sort of serious, hardcore, violent crimes where people were injured. In fact, the defendant himself has been shot before when he was a victim of the crime. So, again, in terms of protecting the public, there's not enough in the record for that to be a case. Again, the court said it was making a finding that the criminal history category should be higher, which makes one think that he's making a specific 4A 1.3 finding, which goes to your point. So in conclusion, we ask you to reverse and remand the sentence. Thank you.
Mr. Drake, you took this case by appointment, did you not?
Yes, sir.
Thank you very much. You have appreciation of the court for your representation of your client. Case will be taken under advisement, and court will be in recess.